backed her up, Larry said. She didn't do it alone. Doesn't matter. You're loyal to her, would risk your life for her. There's more to being dominant than just muscle or guns. Larry looked puzzled. What do you mean, dominant? I feel like I'm missing part of the conversation. Why are you working so damn hard at not being human, Jason? I asked. He smiled and went back to his breakfast. Answer me, Jason. He finished off his eggs and said, No. What's going on? Larry said. Mind games, I said. Larry made an exasperated noise. Someone explain to me why we had to pull a gun on someone who's supposed to be on our side. Jean-Claude keeps telling me Richard isn't any more human than he is. Jason's little display helps emphasize that, doesn't it, Wolf Boy? Jason ate the rest of his food like we weren't there. Answer me, I said. He turned on the bar stool, putting his elbows behind him. I have too many masters now, Anita. I don't need another one. And I've got too many monsters messing with me right now. Don't add yourself to the list, Jason.
Is it a short list? He asked.
Gets shorter all the time, I said. He smiled and slid off the bar stool.
Is anybody tired but me?
Larry and I stared at him. The werewolf didn't look tired.
More than I could say for us mere humans.
Jason wasn't going to answer my questions, and they weren't important enough to shoot him over.
Stalemate.
Fine. Where are you sleeping? I asked.
If you trust me not to eat him, in Larry's room.
No way, I said.
You want me here with you?
I told him he could stay in my room on the ride over, Larry said. That was before he pulled the werewolf crap, I said. Larry shrugged. You've got the master of the city tucked into your bed. I think I can handle one werewolf. I didn't think so, but I didn't want to discuss it in front of the werewolf. No, Larry. He was instantly angry. What do I have to do to prove myself to you? Stay alive, I said. What's that supposed to mean? You're not a shooter, Larry. I was willing to shoot him. Larry pointed to the smiling werewolf. I know. Because I'm not trigger-happy, you don't trust me to handle myself? I sighed. Larry, please. If Jason turned furry in the middle of the day and killed you, I couldn't live with myself.
And if he kills you? Larry said.
He won't.
Why not?
Larry asked. Because Jean-Claude would kill him. If he hurt you, I'd kill him. But I don't know if Jean-Claude would avenge you. Jason's more frightened of Jean-Claude than he is of me. Aren't you, Jason?
Jason had sat down on the end of the couch on my blanket.
Oh, yes.
I don't know why, Larry said. You're the one who kills for Jean-Claude. He never seems to kill anyone on his own. Larry, who would you be more afraid of, Jean-Claude or me?
You wouldn't hurt me, he said.
If you had to face one of us, which would you prefer? Larry looked at me for a long time. The anger drained away, replaced by something tired and old in his eyes. Him.
For God's sake, why? I asked.
I've seen you kill a lot of people, Anita. A lot more than Jean-Claude. He might try to frighten me to death, but you'd just kill me.
My mouth was open, just a little.
If you really believe that I'm more dangerous than Jean-Claude, then you haven't been paying attention. I didn't say you were more dangerous. I said you'd kill me quicker.
That's why I'm not as afraid of Anita as I am of Jean-Claude, Jason said.
Larry looked at him. What do you mean?
All she'll do is kill me quick.
Neat.
Jean-Claude wouldn't kill me quick or easy. He'd make sure it hurt.
The two men stared at each other. Each one's logic was sound as far as it went.
I was with Jason.
If you really believe what you're saying, Larry, then you haven't seen enough vampires.
How am I ever going to see enough vampires if you keep me at arm's length, Anita?
Had I really kept him out of it that much? Had I overprotected him? Let him see my ruthlessness but not Jean-Claude's?
And I'm going to the Masters tomorrow night. You are not leaving me behind anymore.
You're right, I said.
The answer seemed to surprise both of them.
If you really believe that I'd kill someone quicker than Jean-Claude would, I have overprotected you. You have to understand how dangerous they are, Larry. How deadly. Or someday I won't be around and you'll get killed. I took a deep breath and let it out slowly. My stomach was tight with fear.
fear that Larry would get killed because I'd kept him out of it. It was something I hadn't anticipated.
"Come on, Jason," Larry said.
Jason stood up. "No. Tomorrow you can be ass-deep in vampires with me watching. Until you understand how dangerous the monsters are, I don't want you alone with them." His eyes were angry and hurt. I'd undercut his confidence, his self-esteem, but what else could I do? Larry turned abruptly on his heel and left. He didn't argue. He didn't say goodbye. He slammed the door behind him, and I fought an urge to follow him. What could I say? I leaned my forehead against the door and whispered, "Damn."
"Do I get the couch?" Jason asked.
I turned and leaned against the door. I still had the Browning in my hand, though I wasn't sure why anymore. I was getting tired, sloppy.
"No, I get the couch."
"Where do you want me, then?"
"I don't care, just not near me."
He ran his hands down the edge of the blanket, running the cloth between his fingers.
"If you're really sleeping out here, I'd just as soon have the bed."
"It's taken," I said.
"How big is the bed?"
"King size, but what difference does it make?"
"Jean-Claude won't mind if I share with him. He'd prefer it was you, but..."
He shrugged. I looked at him, at his tranquil, pleasant face.
"Is this the first time you've shared a bed with Jean-Claude?"
"No," he said. It must have shown on my face, because he lowered the high neck of the sweater enough for me to see two fang marks. I pushed away from the wall and walked closer, close enough to see that the bite was almost healed.
"Sometimes he likes a snack when he first wakes up," Jason said.
"Jesus," I said. Jason let go of the collar, and it slid over the bite like it wasn't there, the same way you'd hide a hickey. Jason sat there looking harmless. He was exactly my height and had the face of a knowledgeable angel.
"Richard didn't let Jean-Claude snack on him," I said.
"No,"
he said.
"No, that's all you have to say?"
"What do you want me to say, Anita?"
I thought about that for a second.
"I want you to be outraged, angry."
"Why?" I shook my head.
"Go to bed, Jason. You're making me tired."
He went into the bedroom without another word. I didn't peek to see if he changed into a wolf and curled up on the carpet, or if he crawled into bed beside the corpse. None of my business, or at least nothing I wanted to see.
Chapter 20. I put the Browning under the pillow with the safety on. At home, with the gun in the special holster I'd added to the headboard of the bed, the safety would have been off. But I'd look pretty silly if I accidentally shot myself during the night. Day. Trying to protect myself from werewolves. The Firestar I put under the couch cushion, safety on. Normally it would have been in my luggage, but I was feeling just a little insecure. The knives were in the luggage. Things weren't quite dangerous enough to wear the wrist sheaths to bed. Besides, they weren't very comfortable, not to sleep in anyway. I had just settled down for a long day's sleep when I realized I hadn't called Special Agent Bradford. Damn. I threw the blanket back and padded to the telephone in nothing but a t-shirt and undies. Yes, the Browning came with me. Doesn't do you a damn bit of good to have a weapon if it isn't with you. I dialed the number and got no answer. Fancy that. Didn't everyone work 24 hours a day? I had his beeper number. Could the news about Xavier wait? Would even having the name help them? Agent Bradford had made it very clear that I was persona non grata. First, Fremont had blackballed me. Second, the Quinlans were threatening to sue everybody unless I was kept away from the case. I'd done such a bang-up job protecting their family, they didn't want a repeat. They seemed to think I'd get their son killed. Fancy that. I had Bradford's beeper number. He'd given strict orders that if I found out anything, I was to tell him and only him. Made me not want to tell him a bloody thing. But who was I to say the FBI didn't have a vampire file somewhere? Maybe the name would mean something to them. Maybe it would help them find Jeff. Besides, Jean-Claude hadn't told me not to give Xavier's name to the cops. I used the beeper number. I left my phone number. Now I could either go back to bed and let his return call wake me, or I could sit in the chair for a few minutes and wait. I waited. The phone rang in under 5 minutes. I like a man who returns his pages promptly. I said, "Hello," in case it wasn't him. It was. Special Agent Bradford. This number was on my beeper. His voice was rough with sleep.
This is Anita Blake.
A moment of silence, then.
Do you know what time it is?
I haven't been to bed yet, so yeah, I know what time it is.
Another silence.
What do you want, Miss Blake?
I took a deep breath and let it out slow. Getting mad would not be helpful.
I have a possible name for the vampire that's been slaughtering kids.
What's the name?
Xavier.
Last name?
Vampires don't have last names as a general rule.
Thank you for the name, Miss Blake. How did you get it?
I thought about that for a few seconds. I couldn't think of a really good answer. It sort of fell into my lap.
Why don't I believe that, Miss Blake? I thought I'd made myself clear this evening. You are not to involve yourself in this case in any way.
Look, I didn't have to call, but I want Jeff Quinlan back alive. I thought the FBI might be able to use the name of the vampire who took him.
I want to know how you got the name, he said.
An informant.
I'd like to talk to this informant, he said.
No, I said.
Are you withholding information from a federal investigation, Miss Blake?
No, Agent Bradford. I am going out of my way to share information.
He was quiet again.
All right, Miss Blake, you're right. Thank you for the name. We'll run it in the computers.
This vampire has a history of harming pre-adolescent boys. He's a pedophile.
Good Lord, a vampire pedophile.
He finally sounded genuinely interested in what I was saying.
And he has the Quinlan boy.
Yeah, I said.
I would really like to talk to this source of yours, he said.
He's a little shy around the police.
I could insist, Miss Blake. We've got reports that a private jet flew in last night and a coffin got unloaded. It's registered to a JC corporation. They seem to own a lot of vampire-related St. Louis-based businesses. Do you know anything about that, Miss Blake?
Lying to the FBI seemed like a bad idea, but I wasn't sure what they'd do with the truth. The feds were investigating vampire crime, and suddenly a new vamp shows up in town? The least they would do was question him.
The worst?
Well, there was the vampire in Mississippi that had been accidentally transferred to a cell with a window. The sun rose, and French fried vampire. An ACLU lawyer had sued the cops' asses and won, but that didn't bring the vamp back. Admittedly, the dead vamp was one of the newly dead. Jean-Claude would have escaped fairly easily, but just escaping from the law by using vampire powers would get a warrant for his arrest. Sort of like what was happening to Magnus. Besides, a vampire had killed a cop last night. The police might not be terribly careful with any vampire right now. The police are only human, after all.
You still there, Blake?
I'm here.
You didn't answer my question.
Where was the coffin delivered? I asked.
It wasn't. It just disappeared.
So what do you want from me?
There was some luggage that went with it. The luggage was picked up a little while ago by two young men. The description of one of them sounds a lot like Larry Kirkland.
Is that so?
That's so.
We both sat on our ends of the phone waiting for someone to say something.
I could send some agents down to your hotel room.
There are no coffins in my hotel room, Agent Bradford.
You sure of that, Blake?
My hand to God.
Do you know who runs this JC Corporation?
No. It was the truth. Until Bradford told me about it, I'd never heard of the JC Corporation. It would only have been an educated guess if I'd said Jean-Claude owned it. Okay, I was fooling myself, but so what?
Do you know where the coffin was delivered? He asked.
Nope.
Would you tell me if you knew?
If it would help find Jeff Quinlan, you bet.
All right, Blake, but no more helping. Stay the fuck out of this case. When we find the vampires, we'll call you in and you can do your job. You're a vampire hunter, not a cop. Try to remember that.
Fine, I said.
Good. Now I'm going back to sleep. I suggest you do the same. We'll find the vampires today, Blake. And let's just say I don't believe everything Fremont said. We'll call you in for the kill.
Thanks.
Good night, Blake.
Good night, Bradford. We hung up. I sat there for a minute, just letting it all sink in. If they found Jean-Claude in my room, what would they do? I'd seen the cops pop a comatose vampire in a body bag, transport it to the station house, and wait for nightfall to question it. I'd thought it was a bad idea because the vamp would wake up pissed. It did. I ended up killing it. I've always felt bad about that particular kill. It was an out-of-state job.
The local cops invited me in to advise them. Once we found the vamp, they stopped listening to my advice. Reminded me of now. That vampire had also just been brought in for questioning.
I was suddenly tired. It was like the entire night just hit me in one grinding wave. Sleep dragged at me. I had to go to sleep. I couldn't help Jeff Quinlan or anybody else until I'd had a few hours of sleep. Besides, maybe the feds would find him. Stranger things had happened.
I left a wake-up call with the desk for noon and cuddled under the blanket. The Browning was lumpy under the pillow. At least I couldn't feel the fire star under the couch cushion. I half wished I'd packed Sigmund, my stuffed toy penguin. But somehow having Jean-Claude or Jason find me sleeping with a stuffed toy bothered me almost as much as them trying to eat me. What price machismo?
Chapter 21. Someone was banging on the door. I opened my eyes to a room filled with soft, indirect sunlight. The curtains in here weren't nearly as thick as the ones in the bedroom, which is why I was out here, and Jean-Claude was in there. I struggled into the jeans I'd left on the floor and yelled, "I'm coming!" The banging stopped. Then it sounded like they kicked the door. Was this a federal wake-up call? I went to the door with the Browning in my hand. Somehow I didn't think the FBI would be so rude. I stood to the side of the door and asked, "Who is it?"
"It's Dorcas Bouvier."
She kicked the door again.
"Open this damn door."
I peeked through the little peephole. It was Dorcas Bouvier, or her evil twin. She didn't have a weapon in sight. I was probably safe. I put the Browning under the t-shirt in the waistband of my pants. The t-shirt was a large and fell to mid-thigh. It hid the gun and then some. I unlocked the door and stood to one side. Dorcas shoved the door open, leaving it swinging behind her. I closed and locked the door, leaning against it, watching her. Dorcas stalked through the room like some sort of exotic cat. Her waist-length chestnut hair swung like a curtain as she moved. She finally turned and glared at me with those sea-green eyes that were a mirror of her brother's. The pupil had spiraled downward to a pinpoint, leaving the irises floating and making her look almost blind.
"Where is he?"
"Where's who?" I asked. She glared at me and went for the bedroom door. I couldn't get there in time to stop her, and I wasn't willing to shoot her yet. When I came up behind her, she was two steps into the bedroom, back rigid, staring at the bed. It was worth staring at. Jean-Claude lay on his back with the wine-dark sheets pulled up to mid-chest. One shoulder and a pale, pale arm were stretched across the dark sheets. In the semi-darkness, his hair blended with the pillow to leave his face white and nearly ethereal. Jason lay on his stomach. The only things under the sheet were one leg and barely his buttocks. If he was wearing clothes, I couldn't tell. He raised up on his elbows and turned to us. His yellow hair had fallen into his face, and he blinked like he'd been deeply asleep. He smiled when he saw Dorcas Bouvier.
"It isn't Magnus," she said.
"No," I said, "it isn't. You want to talk outside?"
"Don't go on my account," Jason said.
He rolled onto one elbow. The silken sheet slid across his hips as he moved. Dorcas Bouvier turned on her heel and marched out of the room. I closed the door to the sound of Jason's laughter. Dorcas looked shaken, embarrassed even. Good to see. I was embarrassed too, but didn't know what to do about it. Trying to explain your way out of situations like this never works. People are always willing to believe the worst of you. So I didn't try. I just stood there looking at her. She wouldn't meet my eyes. After a nice, uncomfortable silence that caused heat to wash up her face, she said,
"I don't know what to say. I thought my brother was in there.
She met my eyes, finally. She was already regaining her composure, her surety of purpose. You could watch it solidify in her eyes. She was here for more than rousting her brother out of my bed.
"Why in the world would you think Magnus was here? May I sit down?"
I motioned her to a seat. She sat in one of the chairs, spine very straight, perfect posture. My stepmother Judith would have been proud. I leaned on the arm of the couch because I couldn't sit down with the Browning down my pants. I wasn't sure how she'd take me being armed, so I didn't want to show the gun. Some people freeze up around firearms. Go figure.
"I know Magnus was with you last night." With me? I said. I don't mean...
Heat crept up her face again.
I don't mean with you. I mean I know you saw him last night.
He tell you that? She shook her head, making her hair slide like fur over her shoulders. It was eerily reminiscent of Magnus.
I saw you together.
I studied her face, trying to read past the embarrassment. You weren't there last night.
Where?
She asked. I frowned at her.
How did you see us?
You admit you saw him last night, then, she said. Her eagerness came back in a rush.
What I want to know is how you saw us together.
She took a deep breath.
That's my business.
Magnus said his sister was better at visions than he was. Is that true?
What didn't he tell you?
She asked. She was angry again. Her emotions seemed to collide, spinning too fast over her face and voice. He didn't tell me why he ran from the police. She looked down at her hands folded in her lap.
I don't know why he ran. It doesn't make any sense.
She looked back up at me.
I know he didn't kill those children.
I agree, I said. Surprise showed on her face.
I thought you told the police he did it.
I shook my head. No, I told them he could have done it. I never said he did it.
But the detective was so sure. She said you'd told her.
I cursed softly under my breath.
Detective Fremont?
Yes. Don't believe everything she tells you, especially about me. She doesn't seem to like me very much.
If you didn't tell them, then why are they so sure Magnus did these horrible things? He would have no reason to kill these people.
I shrugged. Magnus isn't wanted for the killings anymore. Didn't anybody tell you that? She shook her head.
No. You mean he can come back home?
I sighed.
It's not that simple.
Magnus used glamour on the police to escape. That's a felony all on its own. The cops will kill him on sight, Miss Bouvier. They don't mess around where magic is concerned. Can't say I blame them.
I saw the two of you talking outside under the sky.
I did see him last night.
Did you tell the police?
No. She stared at me.
Why not?
Magnus is probably guilty of something or he wouldn't have run. But he deserves better treatment than he's getting.
Yes, she said. He does.
What made you think he'd be in my bed? She looked down at her lap again.
Magnus can be very persuasive. I can't remember the last time a woman told him no. I apologize for assuming that about you.
She stopped, glanced towards the bedroom, then back to me. She blushed again. I was not going to explain how I ended up with two males in my bed. Surely it was obvious from the blanket and pillow that I'd slept out here. Surely.
What do you want from me, Miss Bouvier? I want to find Magnus before he gets himself killed. I thought you could help me. How could you have betrayed Magnus to the police? Surely you know what it's like to be different.
I wanted to ask if it showed, if she could see necromancer written across my forehead, but I didn't. If the answer was yes, I wasn't sure I wanted to know.
If he hadn't run away, they would have simply questioned him. They didn't have enough to arrest him. Do you have any idea why he ran?
She shook her head.
I've tried to think of something, anything, but it doesn't make any sense to me, Miss Blake. My brother is a little amoral, but he's not a bad man.
I wasn't sure you could be a little amoral, but I let it slide.
If he turns himself in to me, I'll walk him into the police station. But short of that, I don't know what I can do. I've been everywhere I can think of, but he's just not there. I even checked the mound.
The mound? I asked. She stared up at me.
He didn't tell you about the creature?
I thought about lying to see if I could get information, but the look in her eyes told me I'd blown it. He didn't mention any creature.
Of course. If he had told you, the police would be down there with dynamite. Dynamite won't kill it, but it would screw our magical ward 6 ways to Sunday.
What creature? I asked.
Is there anything Magnus told you that you didn't tell the police? Dorcas asked.
I thought about that for a second.
No. He was right not to tell you.
Maybe, but I'm trying to help him now.
Do you have a guilty conscience? She asked.
Maybe, I said. She looked at me. Her pupils had resurfaced and she looked almost normal. Almost.
How can I trust you?
You probably can't. But I do want to help Magnus. Please talk to me, Miss Bouvier.
I have to have your word that you won't tell the police. I am serious, Miss Blake. If the police interfere, they could loose the thing and people would die. I debated, but couldn't see any reason the police would need to know.
Okay, I give you my word.
I may not have Magnus's way with Glamour, but an oath to one of the Fae is a serious matter, Miss Blake. Lying to us tends to go badly.
Is that a threat?
Think of it as a warning. The air moved between us like heat rising off a road. Her eyes swirled like miniature whirlpools.
Maybe I should have shown her my gun.
Don't threaten me, Dorcas. I'm not in the mood. The magic seemed to seep away like water running into a crack in the rocks. You knew it was still there, below the surface. But for someone who had been threatened by werewolves and vampires, she paled in comparison. Magnus seemed to have most of the talent in the family. On the scale of scariness, Magnus was up there.
Just so we understand each other, Miss Blake, if you tell the police and they let loose the creature, the deaths will be on your head.
All right, I'm impressed. Now tell me about it. Did Magnus tell you about our ancestor, Hlyn Bouvier?
Yeah, he was the first European in this area. He married into the local tribe, converted them to Christianity.
He was also Fae.
She nodded.
He brought another Fae with him.
A wife? I asked.
No, he had captured one of the less intelligent fairies. He imprisoned it in a magically constructed box. It escaped and slaughtered nearly the entire tribe we're descended from. He finally managed to contain it with the help of an Indian shaman or priest, but he never regained control over it. The best he could do was to imprison it.
What kind of fairy did he bring over?
Bloody Bones isn't just the name of our bar, she said. It's short for Raw Head and Bloody Bones.
My eyes widened.
But that's a nursery boggle. Why would your ancestor want to capture one? They don't have any treasure or wishes to give out.
Or am I wrong on that?
No, you're quite correct. Bloody Bones has no riches or gentle magic to grant wishes.
Then why capture it?
Most children born of human and fairy blood don't have a lot of magic.
That's what the legends say, I said.
But Magnus proves that wrong. Hlyn Bouvier made a sort of pact for himself and his descendants. We would all have fey power, at a price. She was dragging this out, and I was tired. Just tell me, Miss Bouvier. The suspense is getting irritating.
Has it ever occurred to you that this might be embarrassing for me to admit? She asked.
No. If that's the case, I apologize. My ancestor imprisoned Bloody Bones so he could make a potion of its blood. But the potion had to be remade periodically, retaken, or his magic deserted him.
I stared at her.
How did the other Fae take this little idea?
He was forced to flee Europe or they would have killed him. It is forbidden among us to use each other like that.
I can see why.
His barbaric act gave us glamour, power. But it was still purchased by blood, Miss Blake. After Raw Head and Bloody Bones was imprisoned, my ancestor gave up his potion. He finally saw it as evil. Though his power faded, his children had the power of fairy in their blood.
So here we are, she said.
So you've got Raw Head and Bloody Bones hidden in some magic box somewhere? I asked.
She smiled, and it made her face seem suddenly young and lovely. I had no way of judging her age. I couldn't see a line on her face.
When the magic failed the first time, Raw Head and Bloody Bones grew to its full size. It is bigger than a person, almost as big as a giant. It is imprisoned in a mound of earth and magic.
You say it nearly wiped out an entire tribe way back when?
She nodded.
I sighed.
I have to see where it's imprisoned.
You promised.
I promised not to tell the police, but you've just told me there's a giant-sized creature capable of mass destruction imprisoned near here. I have to see that it's secure, that it's not going to break out and start slaughtering people.
I assure you, Miss Blake, our family has managed for centuries. We know what we're doing.
If I can't tell the cops, I have to see for myself.
She stood up, trying to use her height to intimidate me. She wasn't even close.
And you'll bring the police, right? Do you think I'm that stupid?
I won't bring the cops, Miss Bouvier, but I have to see it. If it does break out and I didn't warn the cops, then it would be my fault that no one was prepared.
You can't prepare for Bloody Bones, she said.
It is immortal, Miss Blake, truly immortal. It cannot die. You could cut off its head and it would not die. The police can do nothing but make things worse.
She had a point. I still need to see for myself.
You are a stubborn woman.
Yeah, I can be a real pain in the ass, Miss Bouvier. Let's not dance. Just take me to see the prison, and if it's secure, I'll leave you to it.
If it's not secure enough for you? She asked.
We contact a witch and see what she recommends. She frowned.
You wouldn't just go to the police?
If my home was robbed, I'd call the cops. If I need help with magic, I call somebody who can do magic.
You are a strange woman, Miss Blake. I don't understand you.
There's a lot of that going around, I said. Do I get to see where Rawhead and Bloody Bones is buried or not?
All right, I'll show you.
When?
Without Magnus, we're short-handed at the bar, so not today. Come to the bar around 3 tomorrow. I'll take you from there.
I have a co-worker that I'd like to bring along, I said.
One of those in the bedroom?
No.
Why do you want to bring him?
Because I'm training him, and when will he ever get to see Fey magic again? She seemed to think about it for a minute, then nodded.
All right. You may bring one other person with you, but no more.
Trust me, Miss Bouvier. One is plenty.
My friends call me Dory, she said.
She held out her hand.
I'm Anita.
I shook her hand. She had a nice firm grip for a woman. Sexist, but true. Most women don't seem to know how to give a good handshake. She held my hand longer than she had to. When she took her hand back, I remembered Magnus's clairvoyance. Dory turned those wide, eerie eyes to me. She held her hand to her chest like it hurt.
I see blood and pain and death. It follows you like a cloud, Anita Blake.
I watched horror seep into her eyes. Horror at the brief glimpse she'd had of me, my life, my past. I didn't look away. If you're not ashamed, you don't need to look away. Sometimes I would prefer a different line of work, but it's what I do. Who I am. The look faded from her eyes and she blinked.
I won't underestimate you, Anita.
Dory looked normal again, or as normal as she had when she first came in, which wasn't very. Now for the first time I looked at her and wondered if I was seeing what was really there. Was she using glamour on me now to appear normal? To appear less powerful than she was? I'll return the favor, Dory. She flashed me that lovely smile again that made her seem young and vulnerable.
Illusion, maybe?
Until tomorrow, then. Until tomorrow, I said. She left, and I locked the door behind her.
So Magnus's family were the guardians of a monster. Had that had something to do with why he ran?
Dory didn't think it was a reason. She should know.
But there was a feeling in the room of power gently moving on the air currents. A faint whiff of magic traced the air like perfume, and I hadn't known it until just before she left.
Maybe Dory was just as good with glamour as Magnus, just more subtle.
Could I really trust Dory Bouvier?
Why had I asked if Larry could go along? Because I knew it would please him. It might even make up for treating him so badly in front of Jason.
But standing there, sensing Dory Bouvier's power hanging like a ghost in the air, I wasn't sure it was a good idea.
Oh, hell, I knew it wasn't. But I was going, and Larry would go too.
He had a right to go. He even had a right to endanger himself. I couldn't keep him safe forever. He was going to have to learn to take care of himself. I hated it, but I knew it was true.
I wasn't ready to cut the apron strings, but I was going to have to lengthen them a bit. I was going to give Larry the proverbial rope.
Here was hoping he didn't hang himself.
Chapter 22. I slept most of the day, and when I woke up, I discovered that nobody would let me come play. Everybody was running scared of the Quinlan lawsuit, and I was persona non grata everywhere I tried to go. Agent Bradford sent me packing, and threatened to have me jailed for obstruction of justice and hampering a police investigation.
That's gratitude for you.
The day was a bust. The only person who would talk to me was Dolph. All he could tell me was that they hadn't found any sign of Jeff Quinlan or his sister's body. No one had seen Magnus either. The cops were questioning people, searching for clues, while I twiddled my thumbs, but neither of us came up with anything useful. I watched darkness fall with a sense of relief,
At least now we could get on with it. Larry had gone back to his room. I hadn't asked. Maybe he wanted to give me some privacy with Jean-Claude. Scary thought, that. At least Larry was talking to me. Nice that someone was. I opened the drapes and watched the glass turn black. I'd brushed my teeth in Larry's room today. My own bathroom was suddenly off-limits. I just didn't want to see Jason naked, and I certainly didn't want to see Jean-Claude. So I borrowed part of Larry's room for the day. I heard the bedroom door open but didn't turn. Somehow I knew who it was. Hello, Jean-Claude.
Good evening, ma petite.
I turned. The room was almost in darkness. The only light was from the streetlights outside and the glowing sign of the hotel. Jean-Claude stepped into that faint glow. His shirt had a collar so high it covered his neck completely. Mother-of-pearl buttons fastened the high collar so that his face was framed by the white, white fabric. There must have been a dozen buttons gleaming down the pleated front of his shirt. A black, waist-high jacket that was almost too black to be seen hid the sleeves. Only the shirt's cuffs showed, wide and stiff, covering half his hand. He raised a hand to the light, and the cuffs bent back underneath to give his hand a full range of motion. His tight black pants were stuffed into another pair of black boots. They came all the way up his legs, so that he was encased in leather. Black-on-black buckled straps held the soft leather in place.
"Do you like it?"
he asked. "Yeah, it's spiffy."
"Spiffy?"
There was an edge of humor to that one word. "You just can't take a compliment," I said.
"My apologies, ma petite. It was a compliment. Thank you."
"Don't mention it. Can we go get your coffin now?" He stepped out of the light so I couldn't see his face.
"You make it sound so simple, ma petite."
"Isn't it?" Silence then, so thick the room felt empty. I almost called out to him. Instead, I walked to the bar and turned on the track lighting above it. The soft white light glowed in the dark like a lighted cave. I felt better with the light. But with my back to where I thought he should be, I couldn't sense Jean-Claude. The room felt empty. I turned and there he was, sitting in one of the chairs. Even when I looked at him, there was no sense of movement. It was like a stop-action picture waiting for the switch to go on.
"I wish you wouldn't do that," I said.
He turned his head and looked at me. His eyes were solid darkness. The faint light picked up blue sparks from them.
"Do what, ma petite?"
I shook my head. "Nothing. What's so complicated about tonight? I feel like you're not telling me everything." He stood in one smooth motion, almost like he skipped part of the process, and was just suddenly on his feet.
"It is within our rules for Serafina to challenge me tonight."
"Is that the master's name? Serafina?" He nodded. "You don't think I'll tell the cops?"
"I will take you to her, ma petite. There will be no time for your impatience to make you foolish."
If I'd been stuck here all day with nothing much to do, but had had the name, would I have tried to find her on my own? Yeah, I would have. "Fine, let's go." He paced the room, smiling and shaking his head.
"Ma petite, do you understand what it will mean if she challenges me tonight?"
"It means we fight them, right?" He stopped pacing and came into the light. He slid onto one of the bar stools.
"There is no fear in you. None."
I shrugged. "Being afraid doesn't help. Being prepared does. Are you afraid of her?" I looked at him, trying to read that lovely mask.
"I do not fear her power. I believe us to be near equals in that, but let us say I am wary. All things being equal, I am still in her territory, with only one of my wolves, my human servant, and Monsieur Lawrence. It is not the show of force I would have chosen to confront her after 2 centuries.
"Why didn't you bring more people? More werewolves, anyway."
"If I had had time to negotiate more of an entourage, I would have. But with the rush..."
He looked at me.
"There was no time to bargain."
"Are you in danger?" He laughed, and it wasn't entirely pleasant.
"Am I in danger?" she asks. "When the council asked me to divide my lands, they promised to set in place someone of power equal to or less than mine. But they did not expect me to enter her territory, so unprepared."
"Who are they? What council?" He cocked his head to one side.
Have you really come among us so long and not heard of our council?
Just tell me, I said.
We have a council, ma petite. It has existed for a very long time. It is not so much a governing body as a court or police, perhaps. Before your courts made us citizens with rights, we had very few rules and only one law. Thou shalt not draw attention to yourself. That's the law that Tepes forgot.
Tepes? I said. Vlad Tepes? You mean Dracula? Jean-Claude just looked at me. His face was perfectly blank, no expression. He looked like a particularly lovely statue, if a statue's eyes could glitter like sapphires. I could not read that expressionless face, nor was I meant to.
I don't believe you. About the council, our law, or Tepes?
The last part.
Oh, I assure you, we did kill him.
You make it sound like you were around when it happened. He died in what, the 1300s?
Was it 1476 or was it 1477?
He made a great show of trying to remember. You are not that old, I said.
Are you sure, ma petite?
He turned that unnervingly blank face to me. Even his eyes went dead and empty. It was like looking at a well-constructed doll.
Yeah, I'm sure.
He smiled and sighed. Life, for lack of a better word, rushed back into his face, his body. It was like watching Pinocchio spring to life.
Shit. So nice to know that I can still unnerve you from time to time, ma petite.
I let that go. He knew exactly the effect he had on me. If Serafina is your equal, then you take care of her, and I'll shoot everybody else.
You know it will not be that simple.
It never is. He stared at me, smiling. Do you really think she'll challenge you?
No, but I wanted you to know that she could.
Is there anything else I need to know? He smiled wide enough to flash a little bit of fang. He looked wonderful in the light. His skin was pale, but not too pale. I touched his hand.
You're warm.
He glanced up at me.
Yes, ma petite. What of it?
You've slept an entire day. You should be cold to the touch until after you've fed. He just looked at me with his drowning eyes.
Shit,
I said. I went for the bedroom. He didn't try to stop me. He didn't even try. It made me nervous. I was half running by the time I hit the door. All I could see was a pale outline on the bed. I turned on the switch by the door. The overhead light was glaring and merciless. Jason lay on his stomach, blonde hair bright against the dark pillows. He was naked except for a pair of vibrant blue bikini briefs. I walked towards the bed, staring at his back, willing him to breathe. When I was almost at the bed, I could see him breathe. Something tight in my chest loosened. I had to kneel on the edge of the bed to reach him. I touched his shoulder. He moved under my hand. I rolled him onto his side, and he didn't try to help. He was totally passive. He stared up at me with heavy-lidded eyes. Two thin crimson lines flowed down his neck. Not a lot of blood, at least not spilled onto the sheets. I had no way of knowing how much he'd lost, how much Jean-Claude had taken. Jason smiled at me. It was a slow, lazy smile.
Are you all right?
His hand slid around my waist as he rolled onto his back. I'll take that as a yes. I tried to back off the bed, but his arm was firm around me, holding me. He pulled me down to his chest. I pulled the Browning on the way down. He could have stopped me, but he didn't try. I shoved the gun against his ribs. My other hand was pressed to his bare chest, trying to hold my face a little above his. He raised his face towards mine.
I will pull this trigger.
He stopped with his face inches from mine. I'll heal.
Is one kiss worth getting a hole punched in your side?
I don't know, he said. Everyone else seems to think so. His face moved towards me slowly, giving me plenty of time to decide.
Jason, release her now.
Jean-Claude's voice filled the room with whispers like tiny echoes. Jason let me go. I slid off the bed, the gun still naked in my hand.
I need my wolf tonight, Anita. Try not to shoot him until after we've seen Serafina.
Tell him to stop hitting on me, I said.
Oh, I shall, ma petite. I shall.
Jason lay back against the pillows.
He raised one knee, his hands lying across his stomach. He looked relaxed, lascivious, but his eyes stayed on Jean-Claude.
You are almost the perfect pet, Jason, but do not provoke me.
You never said she was off limits.
I am saying it now,
Jean-Claude said. Jason sat up on the bed. I'll be a perfect gentleman from now on.
Yes, Jean-Claude said. You will.
He stood there in the doorway, still lovely to look at, but dangerous. You could feel it building in the room, whispering through his voice.
Leave us for a moment, ma petite.
We don't have time for this, I said. Jean-Claude looked at me. His eyes were still a solid midnight blue. The whites had drowned.
Are you protecting him?
I don't want him hurt because he got out of hand with me.
Yet you would have shot him.
I shrugged. I never said I was consistent, just serious. Jean-Claude laughed. The abrupt change in mood made both Jason and me jump. His laughter was as rich and thick as chocolate, as if you could pull it from the air and eat it. I glanced at Jason. He was watching Jean-Claude the way a well-trained dog will watch its master, looking for clues to what its master wanted next.
Get dressed, my wolf, and you, ma petite, you must change as well.
I was wearing black jeans and a royal blue polo shirt. What's wrong with what I'm wearing?
We must make a show of it tonight, ma petite. I would not ask if it were not important.
I am not wearing a dress tonight. He smiled.
Of course not. Just something a little more stylish. If your young friend does not have anything suitable, I believe he and Jason are about the same size. I'm sure we could find something.
You'll have to talk to Larry about that. Jean-Claude looked at me for a heartbeat.
As you like, ma petite.
Now,
if you would leave Jason to dress, I will stay in here until you have chosen more appropriate attire.
I wanted to argue. I didn't like being told what to wear or what not to wear, but I let it go. I'd been around vampires enough to know they admired the spectacular or the dangerous. If Jean-Claude said we needed to make a show of it, maybe he was right. It wouldn't kill me to dress up a little. It might get us all killed to refuse. I just didn't know the rules in this situation. I suspected that there weren't any. I hadn't packed with meeting a master vampire in mind, so my choices were sort of limited. I settled for a crimson blouse with a high collar and a spill of lace down the front. There was even a little frilly cuff at each sleeve. It looked like a cross between a Victorian blouse and a business shirt. It would have looked very conservative if it hadn't been screaming vermilion red. I hated the idea of wearing it, because I knew Jean-Claude would like it. Except for the color, it looked like something he might wear. I put the all-purpose black jacket over the blouse. With both guns, both knives, and a cross around my neck inside the blouse, I was ready to go.
Ma petite, may we come out?
Sure. He opened the door and took it all in with a glance.
You look splendid, ma petite. I appreciate the makeup.
I look pale and crimson without it.
Of course. Do you have other shoes?
I only have the Nikes and high heels. I move better in the Nikes.
The blouse was more than I hoped for. Keep your jogging shoes. They are black, at least.
Jason walked out of the bedroom. He was wearing black leather pants tight enough that I knew he wasn't wearing the underwear anymore. The top was vaguely oriental, with one of those upright collars and one black button, the kind where a loop of thread comes over the button. The sleeves were full, and the collar was a soft, shining blue that matched his eyes to perfection. It was embroidered in yellow so dark it looked gold, and darker blue thread. The sleeves, collar, and edge of the fabric were embroidered black on black. When Jason moved, the shirt gaped just a little, enough to show glimpses of his bare stomach. Soft black boots rode up over his knees. Well, I know who your tailor is, I said. I was going to be woefully underdressed.
If you would fetch Monsieur Kirkland, when he is dressed, we can go.
Larry may not want to change.
Then he won't. I will not force him.
I looked at him, not quite sure I believed him, but I got Larry. He agreed to go into the bedroom and see what other goodies were in the luggage, but he didn't promise to change. He came out still wearing dark blue jeans and Nikes. He had changed his t-shirt for a silk dress shirt that was a rich, vibrant blue. It made his eyes look even bluer than usual. A black leather jacket that was just a touch big in the shoulders hid his shoulder holster. I guess it was an improvement over the oversized flannel he'd been wearing. The collar of the shirt was spread over the jacket so that it framed his face.
"You should see some of the stuff in there," Larry said.
He shook his head as if he still couldn't believe it.
"I wouldn't even know how to get into some of it."
"You look nice," I said.
"Thanks."
"Can we go now?" I asked.
"Yes, ma petite, we can go. It will be interesting to meet Serafina after 2 centuries.
I know this is old home week for you, but let's remember why we're here," I said. "Xavier has Jeff Quinlan. Who knows what he's doing to him? I want him home safe. It's the second night. We have to get him tonight, or find someone else who can." Jean-Claude nodded.
"Then let us be off, ma petite. Serafina awaits us."
He sounded almost eager, like he was looking forward to seeing her. For the first time, I wondered if he and Serafina had been lovers. I knew Jean-Claude wasn't a virgin. I mean, get real. But knowing he had lovers and meeting one were 2 different things. I realized with a start that it would bother me. He smiled at me, almost as if he knew what I was thinking. The whites of his eyes had reappeared. It made him look almost human. Almost. Chapter 23. Jean-Claude walked across the parking lot in his boots and jacket, looking like someone should be snapping his picture or asking for an autograph. The rest of us followed like his entourage, which was what we were, whether I liked it or not. But to save Jeff Quinlan, I could do a little bootlicking. Even I will toady a little if it's in a good enough cause. "You driving, or do I get directions to Serafina's house now?" I asked.
"I will tell you where to turn when it is time."
"You think I'm going to run to the cops with directions to her house?"
"No,"
he said. That was all he said. I frowned at him, but we all got in the Jeep. Guess who got the front seat? We drove out onto the main road, the Strip. The traffic was bumper to bumper. If traffic is bad, it can take a couple of hours to drive the 4 miles that make up the Strip. Jean-Claude had me turn onto a small road. It looked like a driveway leading to yet another theater, but it turned out to be an access road. If you knew your way around the smaller roads, you could avoid most of the congestion. You would never know from the main drag of Branson, but just out of sight, over the next hill, is the real Ozarks. Mountains, forests, houses where people who don't make their living off tourists live. On the Strip, it was all neon and artifice. Within 15 minutes, we were surrounded by trees, on a road that wound through the Ozark Mountains. Darkness closed around the Jeep. The only light was a spill of stars pressed against the blackness and the tunnel of my own headlights. "You seem to be looking forward to seeing Serafina, even with the coffin missing," I said. Jean-Claude turned in his seat as far as the seatbelt would allow. I'd insisted everybody wear seatbelts, which amused the vampire. I guess it was silly to have a dead man buckle up, but hey, I was driving.
"I believe Serafina still thinks of me as the very young vampire she knew centuries ago. If she thought me a worthy opponent, she would have confronted me or my minions directly. She would not have simply stolen the coffin. She is overconfident."
"Speaking as one of your minions," Larry called from the back seat, "are you sure you're not the one who's overconfident?"
Jean-Claude glanced back at him.
"Serafina was centuries old when I met her. The limit of a vampire's powers is well established after 2 or 3 centuries. I know her limits, Lawrence."
"Stop calling me Lawrence. The name's Larry."
Jean-Claude sighed.
"You have trained him well."
"He came that way," I said.
"Pity."
Jean-Claude made this sound like a hostile family reunion. Or is that an oxymoron? I hoped he was right, but one thing I've learned about vampires, they keep pulling new rabbits out of their cloaks. Big, fanged, carnivorous bunnies that'll eat your eyeballs if you're not paying attention. "What's Wolf Boy in the back going to do?"
"I do what I'm told," Jason said.
"Great," I said. We drove in silence. Jean-Claude rarely sweats small talk, and I wasn't in the mood. We could all have a nice little visit, but out there somewhere, Jeff Quinlan had woken to a second night in Xavier's tender care. Sort of ruined the mood for me.
"The turn is just ahead to your right, ma petite."
Jean-Claude's voice made me jump.
I had sunk into the silence and the dark hush of the highway. I slowed the jeep. Didn't want to miss the turnoff. A gravel road, like 100 other gravel roads, spilled off the main road. There was nothing to make it stand out. Nothing special. The road was narrow, with trees growing so close on either side it was like driving through a tunnel. The naked branches of trees curved around us like interlocking pieces of a wall. The headlights slid over the nearly naked trees, bouncing when the jeep eased over a pothole. Naked wooden fingers tapped the roof of the jeep. It was damn near claustrophobic.
"Geez," Larry said.
He had pressed his face to the dark glass as far as the seatbelt would allow.
"If I didn't know there was a house down this road, I'd turn back."
"That is the idea," Jean-Claude said. "Many of the older ones value their privacy above almost all else."
The headlights picked up a hole that stretched across the entire road. It looked like a gully wash where rainwater had eaten the road away over decades. Larry leaned over the back of the seat, straining against his seatbelt.
"Where'd the road go?"
"The jeep can make it," I said.
"Are you sure?"
he asked.
"Pretty sure," I said.
Jean-Claude had settled back into the seat. He seemed totally relaxed, almost detached, like he was listening to music I couldn't hear, thinking thoughts that I never would understand. Jason leaned forward, putting a hand on the back of my seat.
"Why wouldn't she pave the road? She's been here almost a year."
I glanced back at Jason. It was interesting to find out that he knew more about Jean-Claude's business than I did.
"This is her moat," Jean-Claude said. "Her barrier against the curious. Many find our new status hard to accept and still closet themselves away."
The wheels slid over the edge. It was like driving into a crater. Miraculously, the jeep crawled out the other side. If we'd been in a car, we'd have had to walk. The road climbed upward for about 100 yards, and suddenly on the right-hand side of the road was an opening. It didn't look big enough to drive the jeep through, not without scratching the paint job to hell. The only thing that really told you it was a clearing was the moonlight pulsing against the darkness of the trees. That much moonlight meant something was there. Grass had grown over a scattering of gravel that might once have been a driveway.
"Is this it?" I asked, just to make sure.
"I believe so," Jean-Claude said.
I eased the jeep into the trees and listened to branches slap the sides. I hoped Sterling's company owned the jeep and wasn't just renting. We crawled free of the trees with a last metallic scritch. An acre of open land spread out before us, silver-edged with moonlight. The grass was butchered short like someone had bush-hogged it last fall and left it naked and unfinished through the winter. There was a neglected orchard behind the house. The land rose in a gentle slope up towards the foot of a mountain. Just beyond the bush-hogged grass was forest, thick and untouched. A house sat in the middle of the gentle rise. The house was silver-gray in the moonlight. Curling flecks of paint clung here and there, like the last sad remnants of an accident victim's clothes. A large stone porch graced the front of the house, hid the door and windows in a well of shadow.
"Turn off the lights, ma petite."
I looked at that dark porch and didn't want to hit the lights. The moonlight should have penetrated those shadows.
"Ma petite, the lights."
I hit the lights. The moonlight bathed us like a wash of visible air. The porch stayed dark and still like a cup of ink. Jean-Claude undid his seatbelt and slid out. The boys followed suit. I got out last. Large, flat stones were set in the grass, forming a curving sidewalk to the foot of the steps that led up to the porch. There was a large picture window to one side of the peeling door. The glass was jagged. Someone had nailed plywood behind the broken window to keep out the night air. The smaller window on the other side of the door was intact, but so covered in grime it was blind. The shadows were viscous and seemed thick enough to touch. It reminded me of the darkness that the sword had come swinging out of, but it wasn't as thick. I could see through this darkness. There was nothing there but shadows.
"What's with the shadows?" I asked.
"A parlor trick," Jean-Claude said. "Nothing more."
He glided up the steps without a backward glance. If he was worried, it didn't show. Jason glided up the steps behind him. Larry and I just walked up. It was the best we could do. The shadows were colder than they should have been, and Larry shivered beside me. But there was no sense of power to it. As Jean-Claude had said, a parlor trick. The screen door had been ripped off its hinges. It lay on the porch, torn and forgotten. Even with the protection the porch